Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. Let me first introduce my colleagues and myself. We have, going from your left to your right, Professor Benjamin Avanci, Professor Bernard Wong, and myself. My name's Greg Taylor. We're all from UNSW. So let me begin. I'll just spend a couple of minutes talking about this project, the project being much bigger than is being reported on today. It's called a linkage project. So the authors in this case are all academics, and they hold a linkage grant, which is something awarded by the Australian Research Council. As you may know, that's the federal body responsible for meeting out research funds. The subject of that grant is, as you see there, modelling claim dependencies for the general insurance industry with economic capital in view. So quite a broad subject. The term of the project is 3 years plus. It was originally 3 years. It's now been extended to 3.5. The name linkage implies that the project is collaborative between academia and industry. And in this case, industry is defined as the three insurers, Allianz, IAG and Suncorp. It's collaborative between academia and industry, and it's jointly funded by them. And this presentation relates to one of many projects that are funded and taking place under the umbrella of that grant. There are something of the order of 20, more than 20, between 20 and 30 projects, and this is one of them. It's based on a paper which has been written up and deposited on the SSRN network, so you can download it from that link. The paper is has been submitted to the Aston Bulletin. It's been reviewed. The reviews are let's say encouraging, so we hope that to see that in print before too long. Now, just a few, a small preface to this talk. In this talk, we're concerned about dependency between lines of business. And we're concerned about that because it's relevant to diversification, and so it affects risk margins and it affects capital margins. Look at risk margins first. These are calculated at a 75% VAR, which is near to the centre of the distribution, as opposed to the tail of the distribution. So it's reasonable to talk about Pearson correlation as a measure of dependency. Capital margins, on the other hand, are VARs at 99.5%, so deep in the tail of the distribution, and correlation there is much less helpful. It's you can calculate correlation coefficients, but whether they really tell you anything about dependency in the tail would be very much an open question in any particular case, and it may be preferable to use some different measure of tail dependency when considering capital margins. So we're concerned with correlation and therefore risk margins. Now, of course, risk margins have a flow-on effect into capital margins because the capital margins gross up reserves, including the risk margins. So although we're not focusing on capital margins as such, everything that we have to say about risk margins does have that second order implication for capital margins. Now, I refer here to the conventional wisdom, which is still widely used in the industry, and perhaps in the absence of anything else. So there are two landmark papers that seek to provide numerical values of the correlations between lines of business. Some insurers rely on other things, but still, I think it's fair to say that these two papers still serve in some way as a benchmark. And so here's an excerpt from one of them. Here are the cross LOB correlations for outstanding claims as recommended in one of those papers. This is written for an international audience, so we use American terminology. ABI is auto bodily injury, so I've translated it here to CTP, and APD is auto property damage, which we call motor. So there are those correlations. They're not inconsiderable in some cases. Now, of course, these are the total correlations taken from this paper. And for outstanding claims, and the outstanding claims that are being forecast include process error, which is generally taken to be independent across lines of business. So adding process error in to your forecasts actually dilutes any correlation. And if you don't add it in, then here are the correlations. This is the corresponding matrix with the effect of process error excluded. So as you see, they're larger than we saw on the previous slide. So that example contains some large correlations. There are quite a number of them. 0.4 or more, they go up to a maximum of 0.75. Now, these are large correlations, very heavy dependence between lines of business, and one is entitled, I think, to ask, where does that dependence come from? Do we really believe numbers like 75%? And so, to a large extent, the purpose of the current sub-project is to examine that question. So it's important to note that we don't say here or anywhere else that we think these correlations are wrong, that they are necessarily wrong. But we do say that correlations are or should be model dependent. Now, I'll elaborate on this at some length later on, but the message that you can take from that immediately is that that there isn't a standard matrix that you can download from somewhere up there and say that it applies to your work. Even if you think the ones that I just showed you are wrong, there are no others that are right, because it all depends how you construct your models. So we'll be considering how changing the model might change correlations. So after that short preface, let me now talk about what I'm going to talk about. First question is, what should we measure? And there are some pitfalls here. What can we find from theory that might help us? We all know the difficulties in this area, that there's a shortage of data for calculating correlations, and So it may be expecting a lot to expect that you can take some data sets and arrive at satisfactory correlations for your work. But that doesn't mean that theory should be totally ignored. It's worthwhile having a look and telling you and discovering what it has to tell you. So we'll look into that a little bit. We've got a simulation example of some things that can go wrong in this area and lead to misleading results. We've got some examples based on real data, both Australian and US. We particularly want to talk about the question of the differences between modelling the past and forecasting the future, and how you might need to consider different correlations for those two different things. And then at the end, we'll try to distill this into some short conclusions. Okay, so what should be measured? Let's first just set up a very small amount of notation. So we'll have a claim array denoted here by a triangle, and you just think of it as a triangle, nothing fancy. We'll have one of these for each line of business denoted by N. We'll assume for simplicity that the arrays all have the same shape, they're all triangles, they're all the same size. An observation in one of these triangles will be denoted as you see here. The observation Y with subscripts K and J representing accident year and development year, and superscript N representing line of business. So nothing fancy at all. And with that notation, we can write down our well-known definition of correlation. There's a formula there. Correlation formulas always look messy, but I'm sure you all studied them in first year statistics, and I've just written down the standard definition there. But a comment. This is what I've written here is the correlation cell-wise between two different triangles, N1 and N2. So you see that we take, for each observation, we take the observation, we subtract the mean of all observations across the triangle, and so on. We proceed to calculate the correlation. And the thing to note about this definition is that it certainly won't work well for us. It will provide very misleading results. So I want to go into this a little bit, and here's a spectacular example of a correlation blooper. So here's a plot that we've downloaded from a guy on the internet who maintains all these examples of correlation bloopers. If you have difficulty reading it, what it's plotting is the diamonds are per capita consumption of cheese in the US, and the squares are deaths by becoming tangled in bedsheets, also the US. And so the question is, are these things related? Who knows? I mean, I know cheese is supposed to cause bad dreams, so maybe that leads to tangling in bedsheets. Who knows? But the correlation, if you go and calculate it, is 0.95. So in other words, if you eat a lot of cheese, you're in trouble if you live in the US. But common sense tells us that this correlation is probably zero. So what's gone wrong? And this is one of the first things that you get taught in time series 101, and you get failed if you don't absorb this one point. That when you're faced with time series, you detrend the time series before you calculate correlations. Why do we do this? Well, because as you saw in that example, if we don't do that, a high correlation is simply telling us that the two time series have similar trends. In that case, they were roughly linear. And that's something that we could see that. We didn't need to calculate anything to tell us that. That's obvious. So that's not really what correlation is for. Note also that this very same thing can occur when you're working on insurance triangles, because a pair of insurance triangles, if you consider their diagonals, will be are likely to be subject to common trends caused by inflation. Simple inflation may get drowned out by other things in some cases, but that effect is there, and you'll certainly find it in some cases. So if you detrend your series first, correlation provides you with a more powerful tool, because what it does then is it measures the degree of sympathy in departures from the trend, right? The trend is obvious. You can see that just by looking at it. But what is not so clear is whether taking departures from the trends, you find movements in sympathy between the time series or the lines of business in this case. Okay, so having said what not to do, let's go back to claim data correlations and how they should be calculated. So the summary of the previous example was that we observed a trend, and modelling a trend, removing a trend from the data, is equivalent to creating a model of the data. So your model then is the trend, which is a deterministic quantity, a deterministic effect, and then disturbances about the trend, which is a stochastic effect. And the correlation is a measure based on the stochastic effects. So what we're saying when we talk about departures from the trend is that we're talking about residuals. How do observations vary away from whatever model we've created for them? And so this is the case in the blooper example. It's the case for claim triangles, and it's the case for all data sets. First, model the data, which is equivalent to detrending it. Capture all the deterministic effects that you can. Calculate some form of residuals. They're the stochastic effects. Correlate the residuals. And correlation is then a function of stochastic quantities, as it should be. Okay, now, what can we get from theory? Well, I've just been through an argument that said that measured correlations are based on residuals, and the residuals are departures from model-fitted values. So residuals are model-dependent, and hence correlations are model-dependent. So that takes me back to one of the points that I emphasised earlier, which was that whenever you talk about correlations, you must say, you can only place them in context by saying, what was your model? Because you're measuring something that relates to that model. So when we look at the bait up and read example that I gave earlier, we see that those numbers can't be right for all cases. They might be right for some very good models, they might be right for some very bad models, right? But they can't be right for all models. So let's talk now about the quality of modelling and how it affects measured correlation. So I defined past observations, I denoted them by Y. Let's use Y star to denote future observations. So exactly the same system of labelling, but the star just notes that their future values that are to be predicted. And now to make the notation a bit simpler, let's write all the any triangle of quantities as a vector so that we don't have to keep track of all the subscripts. So just Y star n, that's a vector representing the future of line of business n. And if we're going to forecast for that line of business, we're going to be interested in the prediction error of our forecast. And in the equation you see there, I've written the standard decomposition of prediction error. Prediction error denoted by E. And if you mentally make all the cancellations that you can in that formula, you'll see that E equals Y star minus U hat star, where U hat star is the forecast that you've created using your model. Right? So that's the prediction error, what actually occurs in the future minus your prediction. And this equation gives the well-known decomposition of that prediction error into its three parts: process error, parameter error, and model error. So there's that identity repeated. Now, what happens if you have a rather poor model that omits predictive variables? Obviously, every time you omit a meaningful term from a model, you increase the model error. And the other thing that you do is that you shift some of the signal in the data. Since you're not measuring that signal, you shift some of the signal in the data into what you perceive as a random effect, the noise. Now, if the omitted explanatory variables are common to different lines of business, then this is likely to create correlation between the noise terms, the so-called noise terms, in the different lines of business. So the conclusion is that poor modelling may create the appearance of correlation where there actually isn't any. And if you use the higher quality model, then you'll observe zero correlation. Right? So again, we see the model dependence of correlation becoming manifest. So as a sweeping generalization, I emphasize this is a very strong generalization, but it has its germ of truth that model error is small for good models and large for poor models, and therefore poor models are likely to create correlation where it doesn't exist or create the appearance of it. The paper actually contains the algebraic proof of all this stuff, so you can consult that if you feel the need. Now, I'd like to operationalise those observations by means of a simulation. So we've simulated some data and then analysed the data. So here's what the simulated data look like. Simulated for two lines of business, home and motor, and the statistical definition of the observations is as given there, that the the observations Y are Poisson distributed, over dispersed Poisson as it happens. Note the coloured box here, pointing out that all observations are independent. Right? So correlations we measure from this example should be zero. We know that in advance. Now, what is the structure of these of the means, the cell means, for these triangles? And you see there the definition, the exponential of something related to the row plus something related to the column plus something related to the diagonal. And if you exponentiate, that means you're taking the product of a row effect times a column effect times a diagonal effect. Okay, so this is how we've constructed our simulated data set. And you can recognize this as an extended form of the chain ladder. The row effect and the column effect taken alone would produce exactly the same structure as the chain ladder, but we've added a superimposed inflation effect or diagonal effect. Now, it's well known that if the diagonal effect that you add into a chain ladder is exponential over time, then the chain ladder remains applicable. Even though it doesn't recognize superimposed inflation, it, in effect, it assigns it to the other two effects that are included in the model, and it will forecast, its forecast will implicitly contain the same rate of superimposed inflation in the future. So we look at cases where the diagonal effect is not constant over time, not a constant rate over time. More of that in just a minute. We generate quarterly paid loss triangles with dimension 41. It's a strange number to choose, but that's because our real data sets are of dimension 41, and we just followed that dimension blindly. And now here are our diagonal effects. As I said, they're not going to be superimposed inflation at a constant rate. We have three scenarios. One is an annual rate of 10% in diagonals 17 to 28, so in the middle of our data. The other diagonal is 3%. Scenario 2, 3% in the first 20 diagonals, then 10% after that. And scenario 3, annual rate of 1% in the first 4 diagonals, 2% in the next 4, 3%, etc., until we come to 11% in the last diagonal. And these scenarios are applied commonly to the home and motor simulations. There are 1,000 replicates of each scenario for each line of business, so 6,000 triangles in all, 1,000 replicates, 2 lines of business, 3 scenarios. So we've simulated data, now we have to analyse it. So how do we analyse it? Well, there's the data structure repeated, and here's the model for analysis. And you can see that the model is the same as the data structure, with one exception, and that is that it doesn't recognise any diagonal trend. And of course, this corresponds to what often happens in practice. Right? I mean, often you have data sets that may or may not contain diagonal trends. You're not sure, and you use the chain ladder on them. Hope for the best. And that's in effect what we've done. Our model form is the chain ladder form. So what happens when we do this? Okay, so model error introduced. So each of the 6,000 triangles was analysed by that form of chain ladder. We took standardised deviance residuals, computed for all the cells in each triangle, so something of the order of 800 cells per triangle. For each of the 3,000 home motor pairs, calculated the Pearson correlation of residuals. First, over all cells, over all 800 odd cells of the triangle. Then over accident quarters, so taking all the cells in an accident quarter, collecting them all into a single accident quarter. Separately for development quarters, separately for calendar quarters. And the results. Well, we know the true value is zero by definition. Simulated values as follows. Scenarios 1, 2 and 3, values ranging roughly in the range 0.2 to 0.3. So quite high correlations emerging here. We know the true correlations are zero in this case, but by use of a model that we know, because of the simulation structure, we know is inadequate, we see quite large correlations emerge in our measurement. And if you want to look at them by calendar quarter, for example, there they are. So for example, I've just noted in the coloured box here what the different scenarios are in rough terms. So scenario one is high in the middle calendar quarters, which means that when you model it, ignoring that trend, you're going to underfit the middle calendar quarters and overfit the early and late calendar quarters. And sure enough, you see that the highest correlations occur in those middle calendar quarters. The correlations never go to zero anywhere, because when you're overfitting one triangle, you're overfitting the other. When you're underfitting one, you're underfitting the other. Well, let's not spend a lot of time looking at all these different plots, but you can look at them after if you want to, and understand what they tell you. So for later reference, we have a plot by development quarter and one by accident quarter. Okay, so that's simulated data, right? We can always get the results we want if we use simulated data. Right? We can assume zero correlations if we like, but what happens if we use real data? So I'll talk about two different sets of data. The first one is a data set we call the Aussie data set, named after the four partners in this project. And it's been contributed by our industry partners. We had a lot of data, unit record files for a number of lines of business separately for each partner, exposure files and claim files. Number of years varies by partner, varies by line of business, but it goes up to 10 years for home and motor. And at present, we have four lines of business collectively from the partners: home, motor, CDP, and public liability. So in this case, we actually haven't needed to use the unit record structure of the data. We've summarised it into paid loss triangles. That's all we need for present purposes. Some of the other projects we're working on use the more detailed data. But what we've done is to model each of the claim triangles with increasing attention to detail. In other words, start with a simple model and look at how it might need to be improved and look at what happens to correlation as the improvements are made. So for each model, each time we fit a new model, we calculate standardized deviance residuals and take the Pearson correlations of those residuals computed for various lines of business pairs for each partner. And here's the first set of results. We just use a chain ladder on everything. And we have here we have two insurers, A and B. For insurer A, we have four classes of business, and for insurer B, we have two. And we calculate all the cross line of business correlations, and you see rather uninteresting correlation matrix. Everything fairly close to zero, with an even scatter of pluses and minuses, with one exception, and that exception is very high, so 0.6% home and motor. Okay, let's look at that. Now, here are the plots for home and motor, respectively. And the first thing to look at is the dotted plot in each, which is plotting, it's referred to here as total claim payments, and it's by accident quarter. What total claim payments actually means, so it's a shorthand for the purpose of slides, but what it actually means is the total claim payments in the first two development years, first eight quarters, which is actually getting close to the ultimate total. And the first thing that you notice is a number of pronounced peaks. So some accident quarters where claims experience is very high, and other accident quarters where there are more peaks but more subdued peaks. And you also notice that some of the peaks occur in the same accident quarters across the two lines of business. So accident quarter 25, for example, has a peak in both lines of business, and so does accident quarter 30, I'm not sure, it looks like it's 32. And I guess everyone in the room here has already worked out where these peaks came from. These are domestic property lines, so there's been a hailstorm or there's been a flood or something, right? Okay. Right, now, it's pretty obvious just looking at those two plots without putting pencil to paper. It's pretty obvious that there's going to be a certain degree of correlation generated by those peaks. What we don't know is how significantly it's contributed to that earlier figure of 0.59. So let's look at that. The other thing, before I do that, the other thing to note is that the volume of claim payments we note actually affects the rate of claim settlement. So one can speculate, probably with some confidence, on the reasons for this. A sudden surge of claim payments implies a somewhat greater stress on the claims processes. And so they may be processing more claims in number than usual, but in terms of the proportion of claims actually received, they're processing a smaller quantity. And you can see this effect in the data. You can note it in relation to the major events that are obvious there. But I'll come back to that point again in just a moment. Just for the moment, let's focus on the major events. So let's do the simplest thing possible. Just keep our chain ladder, but delete the few accident quarters from our data set that are subject to major events. Okay, and I've reproduced the correlation matrix and shown in red where any changes occur between this one in this one relative to the previous one. So the 0.09, 0.02 have changed slightly, but the 0.59 has reduced to 0.11. Okay, so if we model attritional claims, or no, let's not call them that. We model claims that don't arise from major events, then most of our observed correlation has vanished. But 0.11, okay, still sort of medium size, so let's look a bit further at it. Let's go back to these two plots that we looked at a moment ago. And now look at the minor peaks in these series. I'll just pick one at random, this one. So here's quarter nine, perhaps, accident quarter nine, where claim payments are somewhat higher than usual. And now look at the percentage of claims by number settled in the first development quarter, and you see that it's down. And let's not go laboriously through it, but if you did, you'd find that generally, as claim volume increases, rate of settlement decreases. And you can also note that this is a seasonal effect. It appears that claim volumes are higher in the summer months, and we can probably guess the weather reasons for that as well. This is a predictable effect, right? I mean, it's a seasonal effect. We can expect that on the whole, each summer we can expect a higher volume of claim payments and a somewhat slower rate of settlement. So let's recognise that in our model. And I can go into that later if anyone wants to ask questions, but we've added some interaction terms that recognise a seasonal effect in development quarters 1, 2 and 3. And when we use that model and calculate correlations, the home motor correlation becomes minus 0.01. All right, let's now try to draw some conclusions from all this. So the sum total of that study is, first, that for all pairs of lines of business other than home and motor, all pairs that we had to which we had access, other than home and motor, there was no statistically non-zero correlation found. And this was even without any attempt to do fancy things with modelling, just using chain ladders. Home and motor required more care. At the superficial level, those two are highly correlated, around 0.6. But the majority of that is accounted for by a handful of natural events. And the correlation experience declines to 0.1 when that effect is removed from the data. And even that low correlation is accounted for by seasonal factors. And if the model allows for those, then the correlation vanishes. So at that point, we're left with no correlation between any lines of business. I mentioned a second data set, so we've looked at US evidence, because I guess one has to admit that two Australian insurers with four lines of business in one case and two in the other is not a very extensive sample. So we've looked at US evidence where there's much more data. So we've applied chain ladder modelling to a data set called the Myers-Shi data set, which is an extraction from Schedule P returns in the US and covers a very large number of companies. We've calculated Pearson correlations again for four lines of business, the ones noted there. And I've given the American codes for them, as they'll be used on the next slide. And here is the correlation matrix. So again, it's more or less totally devoid of any interest. And again, even with nothing fancy, just chain ladder modelling. Okay, so let's stop and consider where we've got to. It appears from the material through which I've just gone that you have to struggle quite hard to find any correlations between claims in different lines of business. And then the next question is, well, what does that mean for forecasting? Does it mean that we should assume zero correlation when we calculate risk margins? Well, the answer is probably not. So I just want to talk a bit about modelling the past as opposed to forecasting the future. So here in its briefest possible form is our observation equation, which will be used for prediction as well. So y is equals a function of predictors plus noise, right? So you can't express it more simply than that. But let's look at what the predictors are. So I'm classifying them here into three categories. The first I call static, so that's like accident quarter. It's fixed when the claim arises and it's never going to change. And so you can use it in your modelling, you can use it in your forecasting. It's a fixed number. Second one, I call time predictors, and these are things like development quarter. They vary as time advances, but they vary in a predictable way. So you know if you've observed something happens in development quarter 10 in the past, then you know when every claim is going to reach. You know exactly when it's going to reach development quarter 10. And then the third category is unpredictable, and these are things like superimposed inflation. Just as one example, you may observe it in the past, you may measure it well in the past, but that doesn't mean that you know what it will be in the future. So all of these, the effects of all of these predictors can be modelled in past data, and their effects can be removed from past data. And that's exactly what we've been talking about for the last 50 minutes. But of course they need to be reinserted into the predictions of future cells. And when you do that, two of those effects, two of the predictors will have certain values in your future cells, but the third category will have uncertain values. So if we look at the effect of reinserting those predictors, the effects of those predictors on prediction error, well, it will be nil in the first two cases because they're known quantities, right? But in the third case, where the quantity that we're inserting is uncertain, it will cause an increase in prediction error. And it may cause sympathetic increases in prediction error across different lines of business and hence correlation between them. And superimposed inflation is a perfect example, and all the insurers who run capital models specifically include that one as generating correlation in their future predictions. Okay, so the inferences to be drawn from that first, although you may be able to model away all correlation in past data, it may not be correct to assume zero correlation in the future. And the extent to which it's incorrect to make that assumption depends on the extent to which unpredictable predictors are used in the model. For example, superimposed inflation, major events, claim management changes, add to the list at will. So again, correlation is model dependent, and models of the past and future may need to differ. So let's come to the final conclusions. Dependencies between lines of business are not absolutes. They depend heavily on the claims models that you use. And if you're willing to pay attention to some detail, you may be able to model away virtually all correlation in past data. As a broad generalisation, better modelling leads to less perceived dependency and the converse. A possible consequence of poor modelling is the creation of perceived correlation where, in fact, there is none. And this correlation might very well be positive. If it is, then it will reduce the measured diversification credit. In other words, if you're an insurer, you're slugging yourself unnecessarily, and it will increase risk margins. And it will increase the insurance risk capital margin. Although it may be possible to model this away in past data, it may not be correct to assume zero correlation for the future, and consideration needs to be given to allowance for dependencies in relation to unpredictable explanatory variables. Procedure of modelling away dependency and then reinserting it, well, you may say, well, why do you want to do that? Why do you want to take something out of the data, then put it back in? But the point is, you're taking it out of past data, you're putting it into future data. That's a different thing. I mean, you can take out a number of natural events from past data, but you'll put different ones in future data. The conclusions the past ones may have led you to in the data may be quite inappropriate. They may have been unusually high or low in frequency in the past. So to remove that dependency and then reinsert it is a more accurate reflection of the world than simply ignoring it, and will not, in general, produce the same result as ignoring it. Thank you. So I gather we have time for questions, so please feel free. Yeah, Dimitri.
So, obviously, I guess the difficulty to try to do there is to build almost, you wouldn't say it's really a causal model, but some kind of structural model that explains the observed, observed dependency in terms of some kind of factors that might be causing it. I mean, superimposed inflation itself is a kind of catch-all phrase, right? So there's some probably structure to that and so on. So trying to build up kind of that structure in terms of factors that can affect different parts of your business, so that by simulating the dependency structure of those factors and see how it kind of comes out in terms of the loss distribution. I mean, that's obviously, I guess, one approach of dealing with it. But do you think, would it be beneficial to perhaps try to just adopt, in, I mean, not to try to model that fine structure, but instead to just maybe, I don't know, do a chain later on the whole portfolio, you know, and then just use that, you know, to get your overall number?
Difficult question. I suppose I'm very conditioned in my views on these things by the fact that I spent a lot of years arguing cases in semi-adversarial contexts in which one simply couldn't do that, because the moment that you omitted fine structure, you were open to attack. And so you always had to try to build it. You obviously have to observe the limitations on what can be done, but you always have to make the attempt. Now, that's just me. It's not everyone else. But to some extent, the regulatory framework does make it everyone else. You have external peer reviews, for example. You have regulators looking over your shoulder at what you're doing and ready to question anything they perceive is inadequate. So in the world in which we live, I don't think you can do that. As a more philosophical question, I don't know. That's my answer. I don't know. I've never tried it. I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, maybe I can add something to that. I suppose perhaps you could do that if the past was really related to what's going to happen in the future, but you can't really know that. So things will change, your portfolio, your mix of risks will change, the regulatory environment will change, the ways the cases are argued in front of the court will change, and so on. So. I mean, I'm in favor of parsimony as well, but perhaps this argument should be directed to other developments. One of the things we're only touching on in this paper is that correlation might not be the best model to use for modeling dependencies, but one of the conclusions you can have from some of the slides you have there is that when you are considering those effects that might include dependencies in future data that are random. Currently, the approach in Solvency II and in Australia as well, and in the practice, is to use a correlation as a proxy of those things that will introduce dependencies. And one of the things we are interested in developing in this project is to actually look at the data at the more micro level. The micro level, and try to understand the actual drivers of those dependencies. So the idea here is not to have a more complicated model, but to focus on what actually matters. It's not clear to us what actually matters for those future dependencies. But having big data sets with a lot of detail, then we can try and gather information about that. It's one of the things we focus on.
So you probably at that point, because you have to go to maybe modeling at a lower level and look at impacts of different things on individual claims or individual policies and so on, and try to build something from that level, because I guess here we're in kind of uncomfortable world where we're using aggregated, kind of in some sense, micro data, and then we try to introduce this fine structure of the data that we've got for the project, like just triangles, right? We can't really know how we want to manage.
Yeah, in fact, that's exactly part of this project, is actually looking at this fine data, because if you aggregate everything, right, like the extreme example you suggested of looking at a whole portfolio at one thing, if there are no, if they are really the same and there's no additional information, fine, you may try to do that. But I think most people would contend that there are useful information there, so you need to model that to fill out for these things.
Yeah, I guess I hear your question as coming from the camp of Basel pushback, if you like, in that as Basel has added more and more layers of complexity to its requirements, you have a greater number of people questioning the basic principles to which they're working, and things like 99.5 percentiles. You know, are they in pixie land or are they real? And so now there's an argument about detailed models versus what you might call normative models, that they just give a result for regulatory purposes, and no one actually believes the structure on which they're built, but they just produce a result and you have to conform with that result. And so your suggestion's a little bit in that camp.
No, I think that's an interesting distinction. Yeah, I haven't thought about it in those terms. Yeah, so thanks, yeah.
Yeah, Milton.
Thanks, Greg, for your presentation. Has there been any attempt to look at nonlinear dependency in the data, or are there data limitations that would not make it worthwhile?
You mean nonlinear as opposed to the linear correlation, the linear assumed by correlation coefficients?
Yes.
Yeah. No, there hasn't. As I explained at the start, the focus here was on lower or sort of mid-range percentiles, where there's every reason to believe that Pearson correlation operates effectively. So the answer is no in this project. There are other projects going on, though, where the focus is switched to the tail of the distribution, that is, the part of the distribution that affects capital margins at the 99.5% VAR. And here, we would have to say we have no faith whatsoever in the Pearson correlation, and we're looking at other measures. I mean, tail dependence is the obvious measure to look at, but we won't necessarily restrict ourselves to that. But we will be taking an interest in the coming months in questions of dependency that affect the tails, and therefore affect capital margins.
I find Greg's answer very moderate. I would have answered a big yes. In fact, about every single other project we're working on does not consider linear dependency, and we have different approaches to it, but we're really focusing on what I said before, trying to model or proxy the effects that lead to dependencies in a better way, and trying to gather more information from the micro-level data, which is the extraordinary nature of the data set we have. To my knowledge, we're the only ones in the world to have such an extensive data set with micro-level. So there's a lot of stuff to do, and it's quite interesting.
I'd like to add, although as Greg said, the focus is not on the tail dependence and different levels, different measures of dependency. Part of this work, as part of this paper, we actually did also just benchmark what happened if you use rank correlation just to get a feel. And the answer, it's basically very similar. I mean, as you would expect, the correlation is 0.05. We've got very similar results. It's not the focus of this work, but we did benchmark that as well, very briefly.
And Kendall's as well, and the same story once again. I have a question sent from the webinar by Calvin Teng. The question reads, Pearson correlation of zero means that there is no linear dependency between the lines of business. Does the study also explore other dependency structures? And do they also yield no or low dependency? So I think, Calvin, we've just covered the question.
My question is just about the connection between the conclusions of this project or sub-project and the two risk margin papers that you referred to initially. Is the fact that they're coming up with such high correlations, and I must admit I haven't looked back at them recently, due to the fact that they haven't gone into the detail and tried to model those structural events in the past and taken them out, and therefore they represent correlations when you kind of don't do that, or something else?
Well, you can read the papers and you'll get a certain amount of information about where their results came from. The two papers are slightly different, only slightly. I was actually in the room when the correlation matrix was produced for one of those papers, it consisted of the construction of the correlation matrix consisted of a number of grey-haired actuaries saying, well, I reckon it's probably some number, and then that became enshrined. Now, to be fair to the other paper, they made some appeal to loss ratio data, and they looked at correlation between loss ratio data. So I think the answer to your question there is that no, they didn't remove effects and then reinsert them. But in that case, I mean, that was the one exception to the proposition that all of these numbers are guesswork.
Of course, it would be the correct interpretation.
So just to follow up on that, it is the correct interpretation of your results, right? That you haven't really removed any structure, with exception of just the usual chain ladder, right? So it's really just after essentially looking at chain ladder residuals there. So it is some evidence too that perhaps it should be lower, right? Because you would than what is published in those two papers. Then because I mean, of course there is nothing really random about the chain ladder, right? So there's no dependency introduced by the structure.
Well, that's right. Yeah, if I interpret your question right, we have only looked at the modelling phase. We haven't looked at the forecasting phase where correlations could become manifest again. And so we haven't made any pronouncements on the size of the correlations that should be used in that forecasting phase.
But the only structure you've removed is just the changes, the standard chain ladders.
Depending on home and motor, we actually removed the seasonal effects, the settlement speed.
Yeah.
But it started at 0.6 and it ended up at 0.59,
yeah.
And it ended up at minus 0.01, but it started at 0.59.
Okay.
So right,
and those two effects are random. So if you were to forecast those lines, and you were not actually modelling those things directly, you would need to allow for some correlation, presumably.
Okay.
Well, yes. In that example, we removed two effects. One was the effect of natural events.
Yeah.
Second, we removed seasonal effects.
Okay.
Now, there's no reason to load anything. Any correlation for seasonal effects, they're deterministic effects, or supposed to be.
Smooth over time, over the years, probably over 1 year. Yeah.
But in terms of natural events, right, we removed the ones that occurred in the past, and we would need to add back and allowance in the future. That would create a correlation, but not necessarily the one you saw in the past.
Presumably, correlation is a very bad model for natural events.
Thank you.
Thanks for the presentation. I just wanted to ask, like you mentioned about the forecast future based on like kind of factors and drivers. What are your views on like how would you go about quantifying those factors? Because obviously historical data is not very useful in determining these factors. What are your views about how to approach this?
Well, the main view is that it's better to identify which factors do generate correlation in the future and which ones don't. And I mean, if you ignore the problem, you basically what you're doing is you're measuring some form of correlation in the past, and you're assuming that all those effects that occurred in the past that cause that correlation are going to occur again in the future. And what's more, that some of those effects that you could have recognised you could have modelled and then reproduced in the future, causing no correlation, you're going to load up in as future correlation because you didn't bother to model them. So that's my first proposition, that it's better to recognise what is actually in the model and do what you can with it. Right. At the end of the day, there are lots of numbers that you need to construct risk margins and capital margins that you don't know. And as you say, you don't have much data to rely on. So ultimately, there's a lot of guesswork to be made. But I'd maintain it's better if you're guessing at the right things. If you have a clear idea of what it is that whose measure you're trying to guess, rather than just ignoring the problems that we've been talking about today, in which case, in my mind anyway, the observations in the future are all tangled up in some way that I can't even begin to understand.
Yeah, so again, that's the rationale of our project, trying to gather more data, because there's nothing much more to learn from a triangle. But if you actually have more data at the transactional level, and perhaps you can gather some additional information that could help you understand the drivers of the dependencies and then focus on modeling those and their relationship with the actual variables of interest.
But you didn't do any for the Myers Shree data set example.
For the Myers Shree data set example, you haven't applied any corrections.
Correct.
Because they're not available, right? Okay,
correct. Any other question? Yes, John?
So are the correlations an illusion or a phenomenon?
Yes.
Both.
Fair enough.
Okay, well, it looks as though we can draw this to a close. Thanks, everyone, for coming along.